Blog Talk Radio.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
You're listening to Inside the Park. Inside the park. The RSV family. My usual suspects with me. Hot baseball topic. We're just going to jump right into it. I always thought
gambling. What do you think about gambling? It's not gambling when you know you're
going to
win.
He's not coming out late. The RSV family. You're listening to Inside the Park. Inside the park. All right. Welcome to Inside the Park. Another week of baseball. We got another week of Inside the Park coming right at you. There's been a lot going on, a lot on the diamond. Mike, you on a baseball overload yet?
I'm getting there. I'm liking it, though. Liking it.
Hey, how you doing over there, brother?
Oh, man, it has been a blast. It's been a good week, but I need to tell you, somebody needs to tell our boy out here in Detroit that a Major League ball games are played 9 innings and not 8.
Oh, man, you going there already, huh?
Ready. That was upsetting.
There's one loss. Give Verlander a break. He won his MVP last year. Give him a break.
You know what? Expectations is high.
I heard that. Well, we got a big show for you guys this week. We got an acclaimed author of The Extra 2%, a fabulous book about the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, coming on the show tonight. We're going to interview him, talk to him about the Rays, talk to him about baseball, and see what else he's got cooking up. But before we get into that, I mean, Hank's pretty much already segued into it. I want to talk to you guys about who you guys were surprised with in the opening week. Were there any teams, players that, once we look back and reflect on this opening week, Mike, did anybody jump out at you as having just a unbelievable performance?
Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of guys stepping up to plate, a lot of guys you think are going to do it. The one guy I'm going to highlight, and it pains me being a Reds fan to say this, but it's the guy who finished the year, I think, that is the hottest player in baseball, and that was David Freese, and he picked up right where he left off. And why, to me, that's surprising is, one, a little bit more pressure on him to produce, but also in that Cardinals lineup, they're batting him fifth. And so he does not have the protection of Lance Berkman or Matt Holliday behind him. He's got the protection of Yadier Molina behind him. And still, he's batting, I believe, close to 500, 3 home runs, 10 RBIs. He's really done a great job this week. So I was very impressed with his week.
Yeah, Freeze has been stroking it. And I didn't expect the Cardinals to come out and be that hot. I mean, they're on a nice little tear.
They are. And you know what? They're a veteran team. So, you know, I think that's fine. You also look, this is April. Let's see what happens in June, July when those 35-year-old bodies start feeling it a little bit. But, they're hitting the ball well, and they got a pitching staff. And you know, hey, let's be honest. They're the defending World Series champs for a reason. They got some talent, and they're playing all right.
Indeed. How about you, Hank? Whose performance surprised you this past week?
Well, you know what? There was a few teams that jumped out there that I don't think anybody was expecting. One in particular has got to be the Dodgers. You know, they started off 4-1, and what about Andre Ethier? I mean, he I know you guys are looking like you're saying about Matt Kemp, but Andre Ethier, he started the season off pretty strong. You know, at 19 at bats, he's already got 6 hits. You know, a couple of home runs. And, he's playing some pretty good ball early in the year. So that's where I'm going.
Hank, were you a Dodger fan in another lifetime?
I really wasn't, but I like the young talent that they have.
I think every time we give you opportunity, boy, you bring up those Dodgers.
Yeah.
Well, you guys, you know who shocked me, and I had to bring this up to kind of rub it in you all's face. How about those Rays?
Yeah.
I think last week you guys were down in the offense, and they come out this season. They're averaging about 5 runs a game. They came out and put up 7 runs in one game, 8 in another, and they swept the Yankees. I was really shocked. I expected the Rays to be good, but they look real good. They look like I know it's a small sample size. I know the season's just getting started, but they're going to be a problem in that AL East. I'll say that. They'll be a problem.
You know what? They do look a lot stronger than I had anticipated early on. We all knew they was going to have a very good pitching staff. But today, though, but then again, RJ, I don't know, because, you know, for 8 innings, you know, they couldn't find the ball, you know, if you gave them a GPS. And then all of a sudden something happens. It's early in the year. But, you know, just given what you've seen from the rest of the East, you know, they are legitimate contenders for that.
You know, you're right, Hank. I was at the game, and they couldn't find the ball with a GPS. But they can now say they've beaten CC Sabathia and JV Verlander in the early season. I mean, they've beaten 2 horses, and they're 4-1. They're going to be a problem.
Yeah, and Mariano is in there too, Rivera.
Yeah, they touched up Mariano too. So Mike, do you want to take back everything you said about Carlos Pena last week yet?
Even a blind squirrel finds a nut every once in a while.
Still not a believer.
You know what? He hit 2 home runs this week. He didn't hit his second home run, I think, until May 4th last year with the Cubs. Sometimes it's good to be home. You know, he's obviously a more comfortable player there. So, you know, more power to him. But, you know, no matter what you do in the first week, you are what you are on the back of your baseball card. All right? So in 3-4 months, you know, what do you expect from Carlos Pena? Is he going to be an MVP? No. He's going to be a power hitter who hits for about $1.50. And that's what you're going to get.
$1.50. Wow.
Yeah,
at
least give him $2.50.
It's a tough crowd, I tell you. How about, let's go in the other direction. Hank, was there anybody's performance who you were just disappointed in?
Well, you know what? Outside of the obvious, what's going on in Boston Nation, I'm going to go a little bit off the board a little bit, and I'm going to say the Giants, you know. The Giants have not started very well this year, and my concern about them in the West was, you know, if they got off to a real slow start, what were they going to be able to do? Arizona is looking very, very strong. You got other guys in that division that's looking strong as well. Other teams rather, with Colorado, and you know, then now you got the Dodgers coming up. So that's I'm concerned very much about the Giants. Also, Ozzie Guillen. You know, they spent all that money for him to be the face of the franchise down there in Miami, and he goes and makes boneheaded comments that he did. He's suspended for 5 games, and as early as the season is, and with us trying to really celebrate what's going on, or with the celebration that's going on in Miami, that was very much out of touch with him.
Yeah, we'll touch on that Ozzie subject in much more detail later, but to your point on the Giants, man, I don't know the pitching. They got to get that pitching together. It looks like I got the screen up now. Lincecum is down 3-0 to the Rockies in the third inning already. I think our concerns with Lincecum may be valid. The concerns we mentioned last week about his velocity being down. He's struggling. He's struggling. They may need to give him some rest coming up pretty soon.
Very much so. And see, they can be out of it real quick. They have spent a lot of money on their starting pitching. And if it doesn't pan out, that's going to be a disaster.
Yeah, I hope Lincecum gets it figured out, because baseball is a lot more fun to watch when he's going right.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, anybody you're disappointed with?
Sure. So I can think of 3 games that were very disappointing. But, you know, I'm going to go with a guy that is part of a young team, and I was really expecting them to take a step forward this year. And they're really dependent on this guy, and it's Alex Gordon, all right? Third baseman for the Royals, who really had a nice season last year, kind of reestablished themselves, but to start the year 0-for-17 with 8 strikeouts is a killer. And we talked about teams that needed fast starts this year. And to me, the Royals are one of those teams that they need to build up confidence in themselves. They have a young team. They need to get some confidence and have a guy that they're depending on to really drive in some runs for them. Start out like that is a big blow to Kansas City. And I imagine people there are just hoping that, you know, he's going to rebound, he's going to be fine, and that maybe the 2010 version was the real Alex Gordon. So that'd be a guy that I would expect more from going forward.
You know, I think he went yard today, actually. I think he heard you were going to be talking about him on the radio. I think he had a home run today.
He did. He got 2 RBIs, you know, so there's a sign that he's starting to turn it around a little bit. But, you know, it's all about consistency with young teams, okay? You can't take a week off and be okay for a day or two and get 4 hits a game and then, you know, not be able to do it consistently. So for him, I'm looking for average, making good contact. The strikeouts are probably the most concerning part. You know, if you're not seeing the ball well, not stroking it hard, then you can't get a hit. You know, if he's hitting line drives into people's gloves, well, you know, that happens, and that'll even out. But if he's not making contact, you know, that's a tough way to go.
You know what concerned me? I noticed that they have him leading off this year. I don't know how many times he led off last year, but I think he was pretty primarily the number 3 hitter last year, wasn't he?
Yeah, I would agree. And you know, so my answer to that is, especially in the American League, you lead off once, right? You're a leadoff hitter 1 time a game, and that's it. Other than, you know, you have a little more protection at the 4 spot than you do at the 1 spot. But you're right, it's not a prototypical one. But since he's not a National League guy, I don't think it's a big deal, to be honest with you, because he doesn't have a pitcher hitting in front of him. You know?
Yeah, I most certainly agree with that. But what I'm saying is maybe he's changed up his approach. Maybe he's trying to look at more pitches being a leadoff hitter, and therefore, you know, he's getting down in the count and he's panicking at 0-2. You know, I'm just, you know, thinking outside of the box what could be the cause for some of his struggles. And, you know, it has been known to happen when guys get shoved into a spot they're uncomfortable with that they have a tough go at it.
And that's true. And so he may have marching orders from management, what type of player they want to be, but, man, that just doesn't make a lot of sense, right? You got a guy who's still relatively young. I mean, he's 28, but he just had an establishing year last year. You shouldn't rewrite the book on him. And I would agree, throwing him into the 1 spot changes the mindset a little bit for him. And you know, that could be it.
I hope he gets it together because I think the Royals will add some fun to that AL Central. And, you know, it's going to be boring if my Tigers just run away with the whole thing. But my disappointment, I don't think I'll get any argument from you guys on this one, has got to be the closers, this closer situation. I mean, you got guys blowing saves left and right. My guy Valverde blew one, Mariano blew one, Sergio Santos, the Blue Jays closer, blew 2 saves already. I mean, the Boston Red Sox bullpen has imploded. The Chicago Cubs are having issues. I mean, you name it, their bullpen's having a problem. And I know there's been a lot of talk about what's going on with these bullpens, and I don't want to, you know, jump at the gun here, this being so early in the season. But I don't remember last year this many closers having this tough of a go at it.
You're absolutely right. But I got to tell you, too, though, the ball has just been jumping out the park too early. I mean, you know, every time I look around, it's like it's late in the ball game when these games are supposed to be taken care of. And, I mean, they are hitting the ball like it's a beach ball. Anywhere around the major leagues, you know, you can talk about today, you can talk about a couple of last week, and that's all over the place. And you're talking about, as you said, RJ, you're talking about big ticket closers just not being able to get it done.
Yeah, it's mind blowing. I mean, look, you're in spring training. I mean, how many innings does it really take a closer to get warmed up out of spring training? You know.
Right.
But I know it's early, it's a small sample size, and I'm sure they're going to get it turned around. But out of the gates, that's what had me a little disappointed, especially when my guy Papa Grande blew that save in the ninth. On opening day, no less.
We didn't have spoiled.
Yeah, I know. I'm spoiled. Sue me. I want a division championship. But without further ado, I think our guest is ready. As I mentioned before, we got Jonah Carey coming on, acclaimed author. This guy is author of The Extra 2%, a book all about the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. I like to call it the new money ball. Jonah, are you there?
I am. You know that by calling them the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, you will be fined $1 by team president Matt Silverman. That's going to happen. He's going to call you up and take $1 from you.
You know what? And I've read your book twice, and I know better. I'll be getting a letter in the mail and a fine. I would do that when you come on there. How you doing, brother?
I'm good. Everything is good. I'm over at Coors Field. Actually, I'm covering the Rockies and the Giants and watching Tim Lincecum get lit up a little bit, surprisingly.
You know what? We were just talking about that. Is there something going on with his velocity? What's going on with Tim Lincecum?
I wouldn't worry too much about it, and I know I heard you guys talking just before you brought me on about this whole idea of the first week and what he'd do with small sample size and so forth. His velocity is pretty okay. That is something that I would worry about, though, if a pitcher had problems like that. I mean, the guy that's bothering me a little is actually Josh Beckett, because his velocity was down from what it's been in the past, and his location was terrible, too. I mean, it just looked like he's supposed to have a thumb injury, and you sort of wonder, well, is he favoring his thumb? Is that what's causing him to throw straight and slow, which is a terrible combination. But, you know, if you're talking about someone who would make you nervous, so I don't think Lincecum is the guy, but Beckett might be one of those guys.
Interesting. I think I was reading all over the place in the offseason to watch out for Lincecum because of the down, I mean, the perceived down year from his standards. And it's funny to see that come to fruition. But I was at that game, the Beckett game in Detroit, and you're right, the ball was flying out of the park that day.
Oh, yeah. And it's a good listen. The Tigers are a great team. I mean, you talked about your Tigers and how good they are. There's no question about it. They have power hitters up and down the lineup. And there's no shame in giving up home runs to Prince Fielder and Miguel Cabrera. But, you know, maybe you do it once. I don't know if you do it five times. He absolutely got shelled in that game. And, yeah, you saw it live. You can attest. He didn't look like vintage Beckett, that's for sure.
Indeed. And I want to say I'm happy to have you on. I'm a big fan of your book. And
thank you.
Because we're going to talk to you about your book and some of your writing, I'm going to leave alone your projection for my Tigers this year. I won't go into that too tough, but I do want you to know I was reading, and I wasn't happy with your projection for my Tigers.
Wait a second. I wrote a column for people who don't know. I write for a site called Grantland.com, and the idea that I wrote about was over-unders for the baseball season. Vegas puts out lines and says, this team's going to win this and this team's going to win that. My only objection was I didn't think the Tigers would win 94 games. I think they're going to probably run away with the AL Central. I'm just not sure they're a 100-win ball club, despite the fact they have a lot of power. They do have a couple holes with the defense and Fister now being hurt and so forth. They're still going to win 90 games. They're still going to be a fine team. I just don't think they're going to be the most dominant team in the history of baseball.
Okay. I can give you that. Did you see the reports coming out of Detroit today that V-Mart may be coming back at the end of the season?
Perfect. So they're going to have 60 H's in the lineup instead of five. That's tremendous. Good news.
Yeah, I think today's DH Andy Dirks may have a problem with that, but I was more than ecstatic.
Yeah, no, I mean, and he's a likable player and a good player, so we'll see what happens. It actually does create, I mean, I'm partially joking, but I'm partially not. It creates an interesting lineup situation. Who do you put where, and what do you do? Does Delman sit on the bench? I mean, there are all kinds of scenarios in play with all the numbers that they have. I mean, these are all good hitters, but they have to find positions for all these guys, and it's not the easiest thing to do.
Indeed. But let's jump into your book. You wrote the book. I've introduced it again, or I've introduced it before, but it's The Extra 2%. You wrote about the Tampa Bay Rays.
Yes.
And they're taking an interesting approach to winning, if I can say so myself. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the Tampa Rays and what they've done to compete in that tough AL East?
Well, I mean, it's been a lot of things. You know, they're really focusing on under-the-radar methods for winning games. So one of the things that they've been emphasizing for years now is defense. And you know, we had the Moneyball era, and the idea was get on base and hit the PED and steroids era, where the idea was hit home runs and So you had these big fat guys who couldn't really field, but they could hit 30 home runs and walk 100 times. And those are useful players, but the Rays sort of realized, hey, there's no more value in those players. We got to find something else. So they started looking for, you know, guys with diverse skills. They can run a little bit. They can catch the ball. They can play multiple positions. And that's really worked out for them. One of the, maybe the poster child for that is Ben Zobrist, who isn't a burner necessarily, but he'll give you 20 steals. He plays great defense, not just at one position. He'll do it at multiple positions, second base, and in the outfield. He's played some other spots too. They got him for nothing. They basically got him from Houston, and it was kind of a throw into a trade. He was a good bench player. They decided to stick him in the lineup, and he became Zorilla. He became this power-hitting, all-around steals and defense and power and just had everything going on. He was this great player. And they just have this uncanny knack for turning up gems like that. They develop good players, too. I mean, Evan Longoria and David Price and B.J. Upton, these are all number one draft choices. These are guys with a strong pedigree, and they've been very good, too. But the ability to sell out the rest of the roster is what really impresses me, because I think the one criticism that gets leveled against the Rays a little bit is, hey, if you suck for 10 years, you can get all these number one picks, and it's really easy. Oh, well, gee, where are the Pittsburgh Pirates and the Baltimore Orioles and the Kansas City Royals? Do they have World Series pendants, and I missed it? You know, they're not doing that well, despite the fact that they've sucked for a long time. But the Rays have found a way in that, yes, they draft well, but they just do such a good job of supplementing the roster, too. And I think the other big point is that once they get these guys and they're coming up, they sign them to these contracts. I mean, I don't know, man. These players, it looks like they're getting snookered a little bit. Longoria is signed to a 9-year, $48 million contract. I mean, I would love to make $48 million, but for a baseball player of Longoria's stature, that's an unbelievable deal for the Rays. Matt Moore, granted, you know, they give him job security and financial security 9 innings into his major league career, but they're basically paying him $14 million for 6 years with some club options. That could be another monster deal in favor of the Rays. They're willing to take a risk earlier in guys' careers, but so far all these deals have paid off. You look at Crawford was signed to a long-term deal. That worked out before he ultimately left. Same thing with Shields. Same thing with Longoria and Zobrist and Matt Moore and all these guys. They find talent. They identify talent. They nurture talent, and then they find a way to sign them for much less than anybody else would. That basically is the extra 2%.
And you know, thanks to you and your book, I got to say, when they're not playing the Tigers, I've got Rays fever. I was at
nice.
The game today. I'm pointing out to my wife, look how they're lining up. You see that shift there? She's like, wow, I've never seen that. And it's kind of like, you know, they get underappreciated. Nobody really ever thinks they're going to win. But it's something that they're doing that just has them there every year. And
Go ahead.
I think you brought that out really well in your book when you talked about, you know, the new front office. They got rid of their old owner, which you really did a great job of making him seem like the villain, so to speak, against Anomaly. I mean, I really detested this guy as I'm reading your book. And then I find myself cheering for the Rays to do well with this new front office of Matt Silverman, Andrew Friedman, and Stuart Sternberg.
Yeah, no question. Well, and the thing is, I mean, in my real life, I'm a nice guy. I'm Canadian. I'm a mild-mannered guy. I don't go after people. But this guy, Namoli, I mean, he was a gem, man. I think my favorite, and there are a lot of stories, but my two favorite, number one is he invited the local high school marching band to come sing the national anthem. And they get to the ballpark, and they've got all their band uniforms and everything like that. And they're told, oh, no, you can't get into the stadium unless you buy a ticket. And they were dismissed from the stadium. That was fun. I enjoyed that one. And I think the other one that really caught my eye was this elderly couple, and they came with the old folks home. They go to the ballpark and show up at the the front gate, and this lady's in a wheelchair. She's diabetic. She's 80 years old. She's in a wheelchair with her elderly husband. And the gate agent says, hey, what do you got on that over there in your hand? She says, oh, I got a little Ziploc bag full of cashew nuts. She got whatever, 10, 15 cashew nuts. It's just basically to keep her blood sugar up, she says. I'm sure that's fine. He says, oh, no, you can't do that. No, you're not allowed to bring anything into the stadium. And she says, well, I mean, I could go into a diabetic coma. I absolutely have to have it. I need to have it close to me just in case. And, you know, it's hard to get the concessions, and just let me hang on to this. The guy says, no. And basically, the husband intervenes, and a fight ensues. So there's a 20-year-old obnoxious guy who's arguing with this 80-year-old guy over whether his 80-year-old wife, who's in a wheelchair and is diabetic, can bring in a bag full of cashew nuts into the stadium. They kick them out of the stadium, make them go back and wait on the old folks' bus for 3.5 hours while the whole game is going on and all their old folks' friends are in the stadium. That was Vincent Namoli. So honestly, anybody would have been an upgrade from those guys, But, yes, it is the case that Stu Sternberg, the new owner, and Matt Silverman, the team president, Andrew Friedman, the general manager, do a great job on the field and off the field. They market very well. They find ways to, you know, turn over revenue sources. They don't draw all that well, which is unfortunate. But they do these little things that help here and there. And, of course, their ability to produce and retain talent is really second to none for a team with that low payroll.
Now, the new front office, Silverman, Friedman, and Sternberg, where did they come from? Where are they getting these principles from?
So they're Wall Street guys, and the subtitle of the book, The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Team from Worst to First, which sounds very fancy, but it's pretty simple. The two of them, Sternberg and Silverman, came from a company called Goldman Sachs, which basically rules the world. It's a big investment bank. And they did you know, all kinds of things, mergers and acquisitions, major deals, and they worked together, and they were making a lot of money, especially Sternberg. In fact, the company that Sternberg was with, which was bought by Goldman Sachs, he was one of the six partners. They were bought for $6 billion back in 2000. So Sternberg obviously has a knack for the deal and could do good things. And the two of them were working together, and then ultimately, you know, we're about to leave Goldman, and we're trying to figure out what to do. And Sternberg said to Silverman, hey, would you be willing to try to help me pursue buying a baseball team? And Silverman, who was a young guy in his 20s and loved baseball, grew up a Cubs fan, said, sure, sounds great, let's do it. So they went ahead and did that, and they bought the club. And Silverman was friends with Friedman. And Silverman introduces Friedman to Sternberg, and they get to talking, and it's just obvious that they're birds of a feather, and they get along very well. And Friedman was also a Wall Street guy. He worked for a private equity firm, which just basically means that you're investing in kind of up-and-coming companies before they go public. You're almost like a venture capitalist, I guess, in some ways. You're trying to find hidden sources of talent, hidden sources of value. It's the same idea with baseball and with private equity. And so they felt that Friedman would be a good candidate, also a big baseball guy, limited baseball experience. He did play at Tulane. He was a pretty good center fielder, but hadn't done anything from a managerial standpoint. So they sort of become partners. Sternberg becomes partners with Namoli for a little while, and they're both owning a part of the team. And Silverman and Friedman get their feet wet. And then eventually, Sternberg buys the team outright, and then the young guys take over. So when Friedman took over as general manager, he was 28, and I think Silverman was also 27 or 28 when he was the president of a major league franchise. But, I mean, you can't argue with success. You know, you could say, well, I don't know if I want to entrust the franchise to these young, young guys. But, I mean, heck, they've made the playoffs 3 out of 4 years. They're looking very good this season, despite the fact that they are struggling to draw. They're still profitable. They're hoping to build a new stadium. I mean, good things are happening. There was never anything good that had happened with this team once they had that initial opening day in 1998. It was pretty much downhill after that until the new regime took over, and now there are lots of good things happening in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, I love it. I love the new regime. I love what they're doing. But something caught my eye in the offseason. I saw the Houston Astros make a run at Friedman, the GM over there. Do you think he would consider leaving the Rays? And if so, what do you think it would take to get him out of there?
Well, one of the interesting things about the Rays, and I didn't make a huge deal about it, I mentioned it in the book, but I didn't go into that much depth, is the fact that Matt Silverman and Andrew Friedman do not have contracts. They have a handshake agreement with Sternberg. Sternberg just says, okay, here's what I'm going to pay you. And they say, okay, that's cool, just wire it to my bank account, we're all good. I mean, this is, you know, beyond just a business relationship. They're very, very close. There's extreme trust. I mean, you know, I don't care what kind of job you have. You know, if you're cleaning houses or pushing papers or whatever, you know, if you're making $30,000, you want a contract, let alone if you're making, you know, a couple million dollars a year. But that is the case with these guys. And so I think that level of trust and intimacy and having an owner who is interested and invested in the team and communicates with those guys, but not someone who meddles, it's not a Peter Angelo situation, is just ideal. So Friedman's from Houston. That's why part of the reason the Houston job was attractive, obviously, would have been a chance to rebuild a franchise in a big market, actually. Houston has a lot of potential financially. And he's from there, and he could have gone back and, you know, done well in front of his family and friends. And all that's very attractive. But, gee, I mean, if you work in an ideal working situation where your boss is supportive of you and absolute trust and you don't have to worry about anybody looking over your shoulder, I mean, that's invaluable. Maybe you would rather live in New York, or maybe you'd rather hang out with your family and friends in Houston, or maybe you'd rather see what, I don't know, Kansas City is like, whatever. But, you know, the bottom line is, to have that kind of environment, I think we'd all kill for that, right? I mean, wouldn't it be great to have that kind of boss and that kind of workplace, and you go into work every day and you're happy? That is what Matt Silverman and Andrew Friedman have, and that's why I think it's possible that eventually they go somewhere else. But honestly, I'm not sure that would happen until Sternberg leaves. If Sternberg sells the club, all bets are off, because I think Friedman and Silverman could go too. But as long as Sternberg owns the Rays, I have a hunch that those two other guys might hang around for a while.
I hope they do, because like I said, I'm having fun watching them. You mentioned in the Moneyball era when guys were, everybody, all the teams were looking for guys who were getting on base, and now we've got the extra 2%, and it's letting all the teams know about these Wall Street principles. Have you seen any other clubs using these Wall Street principles? And if so, who's doing it well, and who should probably go on to something else?
Well, this idea of Wall Street principles is pretty broad, right? I mean, we're just basically talking about uncovering value, and every team tries to do that to some extent. I will say the one front office that impresses me is the Toronto Blue Jays, and they get a lot of credit in the kind of analytical circles for what they've done, and it manifests itself in many ways. I mean, you know, obviously they're trying to draft well and develop well and sign good contracts. Jose Bautista signs a $65 million contract. I mean, Jose Bautista might be the best hitter on planet Earth. He's only making $65 million. That's pretty good. You know, Ricky Romero signed to a contract where he's probably going to be a little bit underpaid, and the Jays are benefiting from that. So they do a good job with all that stuff. But they do these little things. See, you talk about these extra 2% advantages. One of the things the Jays did last year, they stockpiled relief pitchers. Not studs, not guys making, you know, $15 million a year who are big-time closers, but just pretty good relief pitchers. They didn't pay them all that much money. But because of the weird free agent compensation rules in baseball, by signing all these guys to one-year contracts, you let them pitch. They pitch well. Most of these guys pitch pretty well. And then at the end of the year, you collect all these draft picks because they leave. Someone else signs them. You get compensation. So as a result, the Jays ended up with a whole bunch of picks in this last draft. In fact, the two teams that had the most picks by far were the Rays and the Jays. I think the Rays had 12 of the top 89 picks, I want to say. That's by far the most in the history of the draft. That's never happened before. Well, the Jays had something like 7 of the first 60, too. They had a bunch as well. So they're getting those tricks. The tricks that the Rays are doing, the Jays know what's going on, too. And I'll tell you what makes the Jays maybe scarier than the Rays in some ways. I don't know if you've ever been to Toronto. Toronto's a huge city, man. It's huge. It's probably about the fifth biggest metropolitan market in North America, maybe fifth or sixth. It's just gigantic. And so it sets up all this potential where huge city. In the past, they filled that stadium. Skydome once drew 4 million fans back in their heyday in the 90s. So that's in play, just the number of people and potential enthusiasm. And the fact that they're owned by Rogers Communications, which is like being owned by AT&T. It's a massive telecommunications conglomerate. It basically controls Canada. It's almost like a monopoly. So you've got money from the corporate side. You pay and play in this huge city, and you're run by guys who really, really know what they're doing. I mean, it's like the Rays on steroids, basically. I would be, you know, frankly, a little bit concerned if I'm a fan of the Yankees, the Red Sox, or the Rays, that the Jays are going to come up and bite me pretty soon, because it's getting there. They're not quite there. I don't know that they're going to make the playoffs yet, but I think they're on their way, and good things are going to happen in Toronto.
Yeah, you know, I've been to Toronto. I tell people it's like the New York of Canada. I mean, the city's amazing. It's beautiful. It's clean.
Yep.
And, you know, when it comes down to free agency, I don't know many players who, if you go to Toronto, I mean, you ultimately end up loving it. But
yeah.
They're telling me I got to wrap up soon, so I want to ask you a couple rapid-fire questions.
Sure.
You've talked a lot about Tampa needing a new stadium and how they're not drawing well, and, you know, they don't have a lot of money to compete, so they have to do some innovative things.
Yep.
If Tampa does get a new stadium and they start drawing and they're making money, what happens to the Rays? And I know that's a loaded question, but what happens to the Rays if they become a team that's drawing money and packing the house?
The thing is, it's a hard hypothetical to answer only because the time frame is so far off. Let's say that tomorrow they said, okay, I think we're going to build a stadium. From the time that you actually conceive the idea and the location to the time that you're literally throwing the first pitch, we're talking minimum of 5 or 6 years. And they're not at the stage where they know where it's going to be built or how it's going to be financed and all that. So to ask what the Rays are going to be doing is tough because realistically, we could be talking 7, 8, 9, 10 years. Stu Sternberg might have long since sold the team. Evan Longoria could be, you know, 37 years old on his last leg playing for the Pittsburgh Pirates. I mean, this could be a totally different situation by then. So I just think that makes it a little bit more challenging to try to project. Now, having said that, obviously, if you have more revenue, it lets you do more things. I think what would end up happening is a team like the Rays or any other team in that situation would maybe look to try to, you know, buy free agents on the open market. But I think the bigger thing is they wouldn't necessarily let their own guys go. So, for instance, they let Carl Crawford go, and you could argue maybe that was the right move. Doesn't look like he's doing all that well with the Red Sox. But David Price is going to come up for free agency in a couple of years. I mean, David Price is a great pitcher. He's a great guy. Everybody likes him. I mean, he's someone you'd want to keep with your franchise long term. I don't know that he's going to be a Ray in 2 years. I think that he's probably going to be gone. I think that he might even get traded before free agency because they have pitching depth, and most importantly, because they probably won't be able to afford him. That's the kind of thing that would change, where maybe you wouldn't necessarily go out and spend $240 million on Albert Pujols, but, gee, if you have a chance to re-sign David Price for $100 million for 5 or 6 years, yeah, you'd probably do that. I think it's more just retention of their own star players, because although they have pulled off these great deals early in the careers of Longoria and Moore and those guys, no, it doesn't work for everybody. Price has demurred, he hasn't signed anything. Maybe Desmond Jennings decides not to sign one of these early contracts. So that's the kind of thing you need to worry about. And when you don't have money, those are the kind of players that you might end up losing.
Yeah, but yeah, I hope they get it figured out because, like I said, man, I love watching those guys compete. I know you got to get out of here. You got a game to get back to. But if you could, real quick, tell the listeners about the new book that you're working on.
Sure.
I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to pick it up when it comes out. But why don't you go ahead and share with the listeners about what you're working on?
Sure. Well, I was born in Montreal and raised and went to college there, and family and friends still live there. And so I was a big Montreal Expos fan, me and five other people, basically. And so, I don't know, maybe it'll be read by five other people, you and my dad. So that'll be good. We'll get 7 sales. That'll be nice. But anyway, I'm writing a book about the Expos, the history of the team from 1969 till 2004, which is as long as they existed. And it's a little bit of everything. It's going to talk about kind of the history of the city and how the team came into existence and how all that happened, down to the players. You know, I've already interviewed guys like Tim Raines and Tim Wallach and Cliff Floyd, some really good players from their history. I've got Randy Johnson on my list and Larry Walker and Marquise Grissom and Moises Alou. And I think that it's fun to just hear from major leaguers, really good ones, about what was it like playing in that city and tell me about your baseball experiences and all that. But it'll be more than that. You know, it'll be the story of the city, the story of the players, the story of why it didn't work in Montreal, and maybe a little bit of personal stuff, too. I don't usually write I, and I'm not a big ego guy in my writing or in my work, but my publisher, my editor, has tried to impress on me, hey, listen, you're writing about the Expos. It's a personal experience. Go ahead and do that. So it'll be a little bit of everything. If you're into just a straight sports book, that'll be there. If you're into business and politics, that'll be there. And if you're into kind of a little bit of a, you know, half memoir, I guess that's probably going to be in there, too. So we feel like it'll be a cool project, and it's going to come out not for 2 years. It's still got a ways to go. Comes out in the spring of 2014.
Okay, we'll be looking forward to it. Do you see baseball ever returning to Montreal?
Oh, I don't think it's going to happen. I think that ship has sailed, and I've come to terms with it. It's a lovely city. I love going back, but, you know, I live here in Denver, and I'm happy to hop over to Coors Field and watch games here.
All right, John. Well, hey, we appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule. You stepped away from that what looks to be a blowout to talk to us. So we thank you for that. Listeners, if you want to check out Jonah's work, you can find him at www.jonahcarey.com, and that's spelled JonahKerry.com. And he also writes great baseball pieces over at Grantland.com. So do check him out. Jonah, we thank you from the bottom of our heart. We really appreciate you coming on, and we'll be looking forward to that new book.
Thanks for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
All right, brother. All right, that was Jonah Carey. Mike, Hank, what'd you guys think?
That was an incredible interview. You know, I it was just fun to listen to that and just listen to basically how the Rays, you know, has built themselves up. You know, it was funny, if someone was in a time capsule and they was gone from 2007 and they come back now and they would say, you know what, the Rays are trying to stay good. They say, what do you mean they're trying to stay good? They sucked. You know, so just the fact that they have just been good for so long now, that this is an incredible, strategy that they're working. And it was fun to hear Jonah really talk about that.
Oh, yeah, I tell you, man, if you haven't read that book, go check it out. I mean, the Tampa Rays are doing all kinds of crazy things. I mean, they're having a tough time getting people to the games, so they hold concerts after the game kind of to bring people in. They're maximizing their assets as only some Wall Street guys can, and it's a fabulous read. If you can check it out, please do. Mike, you got any thoughts on the Rays? You want to change up your perspective on the Rays? What are you thinking?
No, I liked the interview. I liked what he had to say, and to me, it just highlights the importance of scouting and player development in a baseball team. And, you know, the teams that do that well, and Jonah brought that point up, that first-round draft picks don't equal talent at the major league level, even keeping talent at the major league level. You know, Pittsburgh and Baltimore being great examples of guys that have just not been able to cultivate their own players. So Tampa Bay has done a great job of drafting, accruing draft picks, but not only that, but developing those players and getting them to the major league. And that gives teams with not a lot of payroll flexibility the ability to make a choice. And one is to make investment in those players early on, which, you know, Tampa Bay has obviously done. And we've seen that before. That was John Hart's strategy in Cleveland in the 90s with, Albert Bell, Manny Ramirez, and Kenny Lofton and those guys coming through. But then you also have the ability to turn those into trade chips, right? And so changing or trading arbitration-eligible and free agency-eligible players for young guys and prospects in other teams. So it all starts with player development. Tampa Bay has done a fantastic job with that. And I think that, more than anything else, has led to their success.
Indeed. All right. Well, let's change gears a little bit. You know, last week we were all excited by opening day. Opening days came and went. It kind of came with a whimper and went with a whimper. Mike, what'd you think of opening day this year?
Well, you know, there's the issue that I have with opening day is that there is no opening day, right? When was opening day? Was it in Japan 2 weeks ago? Was it on Wednesday night in Miami for a one-game series? Was it the next day in Cincinnati? Where, you know, was it Friday? Who knows? The nice thing about opening day is, at least in the past, now, you know, it used to be that Cincinnati opened up the season every year. That was the first pitch of the season right there, and you knew when it started. But this kind of stop-start action of opening week here has really diluted what you're getting. So I think if they, you know, really aligned with what they were doing, had a tradition and followed it, that's what works for baseball, tradition. And they've really walked away from that. So, you know, you really feel kind of unsatisfied with the buildup for opening day, in my opinion.
Hey, Hank, you got any thoughts on opening day and, you know, how it was pulled off by Bud Selig and his crew?
You know, I have to echo Mike's sentiment. You know, opening day used to be very much a traditional thing for baseball. You look forward to it. You look forward to Cincinnati opening up in Riverfront Stadium, opening up all by themselves against whoever the opponent was. The next day, the whole league started. You know, baseball is America's pastime. Why it started in Japan is anybody's guess. That take that from anybody else, but that was the way it was. It was a party in every city of the home team. And for it to be, you know, scattered all over the place, we're going to start it here, then we're going to play another couple of weeks of spring training, it kind of like diluted what the whole event is. And opening day is an event for true baseball fans. Fathers take their sons to those games and those sort of things. So, you know, I think they need to go back to the way it used to be. They need to go back to tradition. That's what baseball is all about.
Yeah, you know, we talked about this briefly last week. I mean, I woke up bright and early to watch the games in Tokyo. I think they came on at like 6 in the morning. But, I mean, you guys are some of the biggest baseball fans I know, and I don't think either of you guys woke up.
Mm-hmm.
Opening day is a holiday. It needs to be treated as such. And I think when it doesn't, I think we lose out to the other major sports. For harebrained schemes like this. I mean, baseball, like you said, has no – I have no problem with them playing games in Tokyo. But you don't open up the season in Tokyo.
You don't.
You know?
You don't.
So I went in the lab, and I thought of a couple tweaks that we could make to opening day. I want to get your guys' perspective on a couple of these tweaks. And I hear you on the tradition thing, and Cincinnati is always opening up the season, but – you know, baseball has to get some life back. They got to get some energy back. And quite honestly, some years Cincinnati may not be the best team to get some life back. So moving forward, let me know what you guys think about this. You know, with the Astros going to the American League next year, they said that they're going to play interleague games throughout the whole season there'll be interleague games. So my thought was, you open up opening day, or we start with opening night, and that night you're going to have a rematch of the World Series. Since we're doing interleague throughout the year, you open up with a replay of the World Series. I mean, you already know that people are going to be invested in these teams. You just came off a World Series, so people want to see these guys back out on the field. So that's your opening night game, And then the next day is opening day. And similar to how Boston does Patriots Day, you start games bright and early, 10 in the morning, game start, and somebody's playing baseball all day. I think that would get some of the hype back. I mean, you plan on watching baseball all day, but the night before you can watch the World Series teams go back at it one more time. Am I off base with this, Mike? What are you thinking?
Well, I always think you're a little off base because you're a Tiger fan, so let's start there. All right. Now, I like your idea. I like your idea. It talks about putting great matchups up there, and it's following the path of the NFL. Now, the NFL doesn't have as much schedule flexibility, so they can simply go with the Super Bowl champion start on Thursday. The one suggestion I would make to that, now that's a fantastic idea, but let's talk about building momentum. In the past, and I'll just mention this, it used to be, and I believe there was a period in the 50s and 60s when there was actually two All-Star games, and it may have been earlier than that, one at midseason and one postseason. How about starting the year off with an All-Star game with the All-Stars from the end of last season? So those are obviously a little bit different from the ones at midseason. Just a one-game exhibition with the best players are, and it's a big party, it's a big celebration, and then you get going with something else. So if the point is to get some attention, some fanfare, why not put all your stars out on display right there and then kick off the season that way?
You know what? I like that. I actually thought of that, but I was thinking, you know, the All-Star game has been kind of lax in the past years, but I just thought of a tweak to it as soon as you said it. What about if you had, like, the Grapefruit League All-Stars versus the Cactus League All-Stars, and you bring the guys from Arizona and the guys from Florida, and they meet in the middle and play a game? I think that would be a big draw as well.
Absolutely. Mix up the teams as much as you want. Have fun with it. I mean, that's what people want to do, so why not?
I think we're going to fix baseball by the time this call is over. Hey, what do you think? What do you think about opening day? How can we fix this thing?
Well, the only thing that I got a problem with the All-Star game is that it's an exhibition game starting the season, so you're still playing. You're still not playing real baseball. We're talking about opening day. So having said that, RJ, I like your idea of the World Series contestants starting the season. What I would do, though, and I would do the same thing, play baseball all day long, but everybody would be in throwback unis from the 60s and the 50s, and they would look that. Then I would throw that traditional feel everywhere. You know, Houston today had on the Colt 45 uniforms. You know, you could have the Seattle Pilot uniforms out there, the St. Louis Browns, if you will. You know, and the Brooklyn Dodger uniforms, all these out there. You know, the old Tigers uniforms. And just have all of that out there and have the nostalgic baseball, what baseball used to be on opening day. Always go back to where you came from, you know, but bring it forward. You know, it would be great to have opening day where your World Series champions always start at home, always receive their ring on opening day, and you start the season just like that. That's what I would do.
Yeah, you're right, Hank. I mean, the one thing baseball has over all these other sports is tradition. And they really got to play that up, and you got to get dads taking their sons out. You got to get back to the tradition, and they're losing that right now.
Right.
I was thinking of something, too, and you're right, the All-Star format's gotten a little bit tired, so why not tweak it up a little bit? And one of the ideas I had for it was let's have a battle of the closers from each league, okay? And here's the situation. It's the ninth inning, a one-run lead, and the other team gets to stack their lineup however they want. Throw six batters up there, and then the top closer from one league comes out, and if he gets out of it, that's a point. Then the other league comes up, and it sets up again, you know, and if they get out of that, it's tied 1-1 until one of the league gives up the run where the other one doesn't. You know what I mean? There's a lot of things. Situational. Have the best base stealer on first base, and he's got to run, you know, and see if you can throw him out knowing that he's going to run. All these different situational things, that is the fun part about baseball, that usually, you know, has to happen organically. You can create those situations in an All-Star type scenario, and that would be a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah, you know, it sounds crazy, but those are some of the most exciting things about baseball. Somebody stealing a base, taking the extra bag, or a closer coming in to preserve a one-run lead. And while it may sound crazy, baseball has to get into some of the crazy to preserve what's fun and exciting about the game, because so many times you hear it's boring or I just can't stand watching them stand around. They've got to do something, and for some reason, the higher-ups in MLB's office just seem so unresponsive to changing this game.
You know, there's a lot about baseball that's very, very exciting. But when you sit there and you try to, you know, do what everybody else is doing, I mean, there are some very strategic things that they can just play up in baseball. Baseball is a very statistical sport, you know, and without just making it a geek sport by throwing numbers all over the place, you can just use things like a Cabrera or somebody. How often is he going to hit a home run? You could almost do a call-in, you know, with fans on time. You know, he's got a such and such percentage of hitting home runs. What do you think? You can make it interactive if you wish. You know, they're making everything else interactive, you know. But I think that what they really need to do is really play up some of the rivalries that happened from back in the day. You know, I know we've got all this alignment, but if you got everybody playing each other, people want to see the Cubs and the Cardinals. You know, people want to see Toronto and Detroit from back in the day. You know, they keep on hyping up Boston and New York. Those are kind of games that they want to see. You know, why can't you have them all play on the same day or all on the same weekend? You know, and just inundate baseball fans with what they want to see. It's there.
Yeah, a lot of work needs to be done. I hope they get this right, because I see baseball losing a lot of ground to some of these other sports, and it's a little depressing. A little depressing. But guys, we're running up against it. But I do want to get your thoughts. For looking into next week, series of the week, upcoming series. What should our listeners be looking out for, Hank? What will you be watching next week?
You know what? I've been watching a lot of baseball this week, and I'm looking forward to one. I don't know if you guys don't even think about it, but Baltimore and Toronto. I don't know if you guys have watched them play too much this year, but these are two pretty exciting teams out of the East. You know, Toronto winning a couple of extra innings against Cleveland. Baltimore has been playing some exciting ball, and I want to see these two young teams really come up. They're right in the middle right now. It's early in the year, and this is a good time to see them play while, you know, they're still playing for something, as early as it is.
Hank, you're bringing it, man. I like that when you go off the board with some teams people ordinarily wouldn't watch, and let them know, you know, to sit down and check these two squads out. I like where you're coming from on that one, Hank.
Appreciate that.
Mike, what are you going to be tuned into next week?
I think you guys are totally off the mark here. There's a huge matchup going on. It's in the Midwest League. You got the Dayton Dragons and the East Lansing Lugnuts going at it. He's right there. There's a hatred between those teams. You need to see it. Other than that obvious choice, I'm going to go in your backyard, and I'm going to say the Tampa Bay-Detroit series. You've got arguably the best hitting team in the league against the best pitching staff in the league. And, you know, and when Verlander pitches the ninth, Detroit can be pretty good. When he decides to up, then never know what happens. But anyway, that's a great matchup right there. So, you know, that's one I've got my eye on right now.
That's a bit of a low blow there, Mike.
Yeah.
We haven't done any Reds talk today, man. Where'd that come from?
You know,
well,
and
we agree. We'll start today.
We made a big week about the Joey Votto signing and how it was going to cost him Brandon Phillips. And if you remember my dog of the week, Bob Castellini, he may just have to repeat because he just signed Brandon Phillips for 6 years too. So big news out of Cincy this week.
Congratulations. So is Cincinnati going to win the division still?
If we had strong feelings about that last week, I don't know what changes.
We're going to ask you every week.
I hope they can. I hope they can. They got to play big in big games. That's it. They got to hit. And most importantly, they got to pitch. And I think they can do that. You know, no one's really talking about it a lot, but I'll tell you the best pitcher on the Red staff right now, and it's Aroldis Chapman. And he's not even starting. He is looking lights out. I mean, unhittable. And it's not that he's throwing 105. It's that he's throwing 97, 94, and then hitting a slider in the mid-80s, and he's got an off-speed pitch that he's throwing now in the 70s. And that's unhittable. And he's doing nothing but throwing strikes right now. You put him in the rotation.
I saw that he didn't he get a two inning save or two inning win just today.
He did. He struck out five.
Congratulations! You guys are finally coming around. He stopped walking everybody.
That's right. And he's not even in the rotation. So eventually you're going to see him in there. He's just too good of a talent. And that's something that the Reds didn't necessarily count on this year. So you know that's a big factor.
You know, I'm going to take the listeners. I'm going to see your Tampa Bay and raise you. Tampa Bay is playing Boston starting Friday. They got a four-game set. Tampa Bay is running away. They're looking good in the East. Boston, not so much. But I'm going to be tuned in, A, to see if this Tampa squad is for real, and B, to see if Boston loses this one as well. Can you imagine the Boston fans in Boston losing their minds? In Boston, that's going to be more enjoyable to me, seeing the Red Sox Nation, who they believe has this birth-given right to winning, go ahead and drop some more games. That'll give me the most pleasure. So that's what I'll be looking out for.
You know, that's a good one, too, because I was just reading where they're going to be celebrating later on this year the 100th, anniversary of Fenway. And they asked Terry
–
pardon?
I said, that's right.
Yeah, and see, and if they're not getting it done, you know, they asked Terry Francona to come back. He said he wasn't coming back, you know. So if they come in there really, you know, dragging their tails behind them, you know, it's going to be fun to watch for all of us non-Boston fans.
Indeed. So listeners, tune in. You got three great series to watch, and we're going to go ahead and take you. We got one more segment for you. Let's go ahead and pay some bills real quick, fellas.
Now we're going to get into our Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. Resistance Digital Solutions. Are you tired of running to the boys in blue? Are you done with listening to sales staff trying to upsell you technology that you don't need? We've all been there. So what did the real sports guys do? We contacted Resistance Digital Solutions for all our technology needs. They are not there to meet sales quotas or make profit margins. They simply just want to sell you what you need at a fair price. From iPads to PCs to flat screens, TVs, or intricate home theater systems, they customize every solution based on your needs. Check out their website at www.resistancedigital.com or email them at sales@resistancedigital.com for your custom technology solutions today.
All right, Resistance Digital Dog of the Week. This week I'm going with Johan Santana. The guy pitched two games, gave up one earned run in 10 innings. Two games, pitched a total of 10 innings, gave up one earned run, has an ERA of .90, and his batting average against was .194. And he did this in true fashion, showing that the win is a meaningless stat because he ended the week 0-1, didn't get one win, and he only gave up one earned run all week. So Johan Santana still, with that awesome pitching performance, he gets my dog of the week. Mike, who's your dog of the week?
Wow. So I think I spent some dog currency earlier on David Freese, and I'll have to go a different direction here. But a guy who's putting up when he's expected to put up, and maybe he's stealing your thunder, Hank, but Miguel Cabrera is looking really nice so far this year. Just raking the ball in that lineup, doing a great job. And if those guys hit like that, it's going to be a nice year for you guys, and I'm going to have to put up with a lot of stuff all year.
Restore the roar, baby. Miguel and Prince. I will take this opportunity to mention Miguel was my MVP pick. Hank, we got about a minute left. Take us home. Who's your dog of the week?
I should make Mike my dog for picking the Detroit Tiger. But anyway, going forward, my dog of the week is got to be a man that comes off the DL against Houston, hits a home run in his last year. It's Chipper Jones. Chipper Jones is my dog.
That's a good one. Chipper Jones, he did come through on that last game. I just hope he can keep it up. I hope he can stay on the field.
That's right.
So that's it. We were wrapping up another episode of Inside the Park. I had a great time with this show. We want to thank Jonah Carey again. Check out his website, JonahCarey.com. He writes at Grantland.com, GRANTLAND.com. They've also got some other fabulous young writers over there. So definitely check that out. And check out his book, The Extra 2%, How the Tampa Bay Rays Use Wall Street Principles to Success. And that's going to be it for this week. Check us back next week, same time, 9:30, Blog Talk Radio. See you.